The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement on Federal News Network. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy, trends, innovations, and debates. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Anthony Principi. He is a principal at the Principi Group and a former secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Tony, it's great to see you again, and thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Roger, it's always great to see you, and thank you so much for inviting me to participate.
Well, I can't think of anyone better to talk about the VA mission, the evolving healthcare system in a certain sense, and technology and how things have changed over the last couple decades since your time as a secretary of the VA and the Bush administration. So why don't we dive right into it? From your perspective, can you just talk about the changes that you've seen in the American healthcare system and how those changes and how they impact the VA's mission?
Well, certainly. You know, the VA has a long history in healthcare, obviously going way back, our earliest days of our republic, and VA came into existence, President Hoover, back in 1933. But I think the real turning point for VA really was after World War II, you know, and of course we had important legislation that was passed. I think that maybe the greatest legislation passed in the 20th century, the Servicemen Readjustment Act of 1945 that created the GI Bill and so on the benefit side of the house, 16 million young doughboys coming back. Most of them had no dreams of going to college. And of course, the GI Bill changed all that. And a generation of leaders were born that propelled us, our country, to greatness in the 20th century. And then, of course, the second part of that bill was the GI home loan program. And so the VA had responsibility for building real estate industry in our country. You know, the suburbs came about as a result of these guys and gals who had no way to buy a home. Now they have a no down payment mortgage that the VA, I'm proud, had the responsibility. But very importantly in healthcare, to get to your point, healthcare, you know, it was the following year that I think President Truman, Dr. Charles DeBakey, General Omar Bradley came together and said, how do we lift VA healthcare from the backwater days of American medicine and bring it into the modern 20th century? And sure enough, they decided to do the affiliations with medical schools. So out of that came the VA being affiliated with every medical school in the country, and academic medicine came about. And I think that helped to improve the delivery of medicine for the VA. And over the years, we've seen constant improvements in the delivery, but not perfect. We all know that. But the VA today, Roger, as you know, is the largest integrated healthcare system in the world, with over 1,300 facilities, nursing homes, you know, outpatient clinics, major medical centers, and they're doing a lot. So they're doing a lot, not only in patient care, but they're doing a lot in education. And out of that was born a great research program. A lot of great research is done as a result of that. Today, the challenges are great. Veteran population is dropping. Military population is stable, if not dropping a little bit. And you've got community care, you've got a large infrastructure system and community care. The challenges have compounded itself, let alone the changes in how healthcare delivered. Getting to your question is, we've seen profound changes in how healthcare is delivered, from inpatient to outpatient to telemedicine. These are all shifts in the dynamics of healthcare delivery, and the VA is on the front lines of that. Right?
Yeah, you know, first of all, Tony, I love the history lesson, because, you know, and talking about, you know, post World War II and the legislation, I think people forget how that fundamentally, those investments in the guys and gals coming home from World War II fundamentally change this country. You know, and led to what we really have now today, you know, the economy, the middle class, all of that fundamentally, those investments truly changed the world. The other thing I think people don't really realize, you know, the people just out there in the general population, is the research that is done in conjunction with the medical schools and the advances in medical science that, you know, the Veterans Healthcare Administration and the hospitals and all that have done over the years. That's really kind of an untold story that I think people really do need to talk about more as we move forward.
You're absolutely right, Roger. You know, think about clinical psychology came about because of VA. The first drugs to treat schizophrenia and hypertension, VA, and medical schools. I'm not just saying VA, yes. But along with
right.
The CAT scan, the MRA, developed in the VA. Treatment for tuberculosis, developed in the VA. The list goes on and on and on. And so it has helped in the advances of medical science in the earliest days. And I think today we're seeing even more of that taking place. But again, changes, gigantic shifts in the environment and how healthcare is practiced and the cost, and all of these are compounded to create a very unsettled foundation, if you will. So right. Where do we go from here?
Right. And we're going to talk a lot about that over the next couple of segments. But, you know, in setting the stage for that, what other aspect of the VA that I don't think people realize, that it is the backstop for our national healthcare system as a whole in times of emergency. If something goes wrong in the private or, you know, or local healthcare systems, the VA was always intended to be that backstop as well, you know, and that, you know, costs money to maintain over time. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, I sure do. The VA is an integral part of the national emergency medical system. I remember during my time, 9/11, we opened up our doors of our medical centers in Brooklyn, Manhattan, as the people who are fleeing the Twin Towers, you know, came north, if you will. During the pandemic, the VA opened its doors. We were ready for an influx of patients across the system. I mean, even during the AIDS epidemic, I remember being in New York City, which is kind of the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic. VA was again on the front lines, taking care of people with AIDS and doing the research for AIDS. So you're absolutely right, Roger. The VA has played a very critical role in all of this over the recent time period.
Yeah, and I think we forget those things at our peril over long term as we think about where things are headed. And, you know, we have about a minute left in this segment, and we can sort of level set for the next segment, talk about some of those challenges. And I guess I would ask you, when you're looking at where the VA is now, VHA, the Community Care Act, the changes in technology, you know, what's your, let's say, top one or two concerns? And just real quick, and then we can, you know, talk about them a little bit more in the next segment.
Well, let me say just generally the future of the VA.
Yeah.
Is at the top of my list. Where does the VA go from here? Because of some of the things that we just talked about. It's very concerning to me, given the important role it plays in healthcare delivery in this country, to know that the future is at risk unless some changes are made, and soon.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to end the segment. And then when we come back, we can, you know, pull the thread in some of those things that we see happening and, you know, threatening that, and just think about ways to potentially address some of those. My guest today is Anthony Principe. He's a principal at the Principe Group, former secretary of the Department of Veteran Affairs. I'm Roger Waldron, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. I'm Roger Waldron. My guest today is Anthony Principe. He's a principal at the Principe Group, and he's former secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, among many other things. And I hope to have some talk about his, Tony, your remarkable career at some point during our conversation today. But now we set the table pretty well talking about, you know, where things are and the integral role the VA has played in the American healthcare system and, you know, the care for veterans and research and the backstop to our healthcare system. You know, and when we close the segment, you know, I asked you what's your top concern, and you said the survival of the VA. So let's unpack that a little bit In particular, I just get your thoughts on the mission of the VA and some of the recent changes, whether it's the CARES Act, the Mission Act, community care, and the growth of sort of out of the VA network, you know, using the VA facilities, you know, doctors and that sort of thing, and going to private or other outside of network, so to speak, healthcare. That what has the impact been from your perspective on the VA?
The VA mission is, it covers so many different sectors impacting the lives of veterans, their family, caregivers. Early in the segment, we talked about education, housing, insurance, rehabilitation, specialized services, spinal cord injury. No one does it better than VA and spinal cord injury. Mental health and traumatic brain injuries. You know, you might say it covers just about every economic sector there is, all with a focus on how to improve the lives of the men and women who go in harm's way, willing to serve their country. And then the moms and the dads who are stoke the fires back home, waiting for them to return. So it's a pretty extraordinary mission. Lincoln, who's my hero, you know, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, his widow and his orphan. Of course, now it's widower, and I've seen many women catastrophically wounded from Iraq, particularly in Afghanistan. The heartbreaking, some of the injuries that they've sustained, even men and women. But anyway, the mission is important. It's critical important. And how to continue to build on that mission? What are the important steps that need to be taken? And, you know, Secretary McDonough, I think, is one of the great secretaries. I just applaud everything he is doing. I admire him personally, professionally. But it's not just the secretary. This is a challenge at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. You know, you can't, as I told President Bush one day, I said, Mr. President, you know, some of the staff want to take me to the woodshed because I'm out there doing things with some of the folks on the other side of the aisle. And I said, I can't accomplish your mission unless I'm talking to both sides. This mission is far greater than being a Republican or a Democrat. And we got to get over that. And President could not agree more. So it's really both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue if you're going to be successful. And right now, and this is not a mentor, maybe it's meant a prison. They're just not doing it as well as I think they should be doing it. They're not finding solutions to some of these problems. And talk about the most recent the Air Commission, Asset Infrastructure Review Commission.
Yes.
Boom. You know, Congress passes it, you know, everything is a go, and then boom, they block the nominations and the Air Commission is dead. Nothing could have been more important at this stage, at this time for the VA. And to take a look at the infrastructure across the country, and it died. So that coupled with it, you know, when I was secretary, Roger, there were 25 million veterans. Right. Today, the number is something like 18 million. By the end of this decade, maybe 2035, maybe 15, 12 million veterans. Military people are staying in longer. The numbers are not as great, but I don't think we're going to see a major mobilization. So you got active duty not growing, staying in longer, veteran population going this way, and you got this monolithic healthcare system, benefits delivery system out there costing a ton of money. It takes courage to say, we've got to do things differently. If you really believe in the VA, believe in its mission and how it serves people despite problems, I don't know a healthcare system that doesn't have problems. The VA just has to be bigger and more public, and therefore it makes the headlines. And that's not to say there are no problems. They should be fixed, but it's a good healthcare system. And it cannot continue down this road, I'm afraid, unless some changes are made. And it doesn't seem to be any appetite in Washington to make those changes. And that worries me. You know, I serve with, I don't know, maybe the longest serving secretary, because I served with Bush 41, George H.W. Bush as deputy secretary, then 4 years with George W. Bush. So I've seen it at different times in its history. And now I see it as a kind of a somewhat of an outsider who tries to stay engaged, and it worries me.
Yeah. Talking about the commission, that was a BRAC-like commission effort to, I would say, rationalize the physical footprint of the VA. Can you just sort of explain, you know, you've written well describing the infrastructure and was designed for and built out like post-World War II, a lot of it. Right. And, you know, in terms of hospital beds and the numbers and, you know, that physical infrastructure that's going unutilized because of changes in healthcare. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. Such an important point, Roger. Thank you for bringing it up. Let me give you a perspective. I'm secretary, 2001, 2002. I'm in New York to give a speech. So here I am, right after dark, trying to get uptown to give this speech. And I'm in a cab or in a car, I don't know, but I'm looking up at the VA bed tower on 23rd and 1st Ave. Now, this is one incredibly big bed tower.
Yes.
You can barely see the top floor because it's in the clouds. And there were like 10 lights on in the entire bed tower. How can that be? And I couldn't get it out of my mind, Roger. So I get back to Washington, I don't know, the next day. I call my chief of staff and say, hey, looking up at the bed tower in Manhattan after dark. Certainly we had power because there were lights on. I said, I didn't see more than 10, 15 lights in this huge bed tower. How many patients do we have in the hospital last night? And while you're at it, tell me about Brooklyn 20 miles south and Bronx 20 miles north. You know, when were they built? Well, what's going on? So comes back in a day or so later. Well, what did you find out? Well, Manhattan was built in, giving you approximations, 1950.
Sure.
1945, 1950. 800 beds, bedtime. Brooklyn, about the same time, 800 beds. Bronx, about the same time, that was 1,800 beds. They remodeled it or whatever, about 800 beds. So that night in New York City, we had three medical centers with 2,400 hospital beds. Or what were hospital beds.
Yep.
That night, the census in all three hospitals was 287. So 287 patients in three bed towers that could have accommodated 2,400 patients. And that's when I said, something has got to change. And I called in, you know, the folks that in the Veterans Health Administration, undersecretary, called in the experts. I said, we're going to perish. We cannot sustain this. We shouldn't be spending money on bricks and mortar. We should be spending it on doctors and nurses, outpatient clinics. This infrastructure was built for a different time in healthcare delivery. It was built at a time that you got sick, you went into a hospital bed. Yep. You didn't go into an outpatient clinic. You didn't get a knee replacement on outpatient basis. You were in that hospital for 2 weeks, if not months. So now we have 170 some odd hospitals. All were built, most were built, not all, most were built at that time, maybe 45 years ago, 50 today, now what, 70 years later?
Yeah, now it's getting up there.
And I said, okay, we're going to form this commission. I asked Congress for BRAC-like authority that they couldn't nickel and dime and say, well, sure, you can close here, but you can't close in my backyard. Yeah, of course. No way am I going to get that authority. So we went through the drill.
Yes.
In some ways, we made some progress, not a lot of progress. We sure did make progress on building new hospitals where we needed new hospitals because we didn't have any.
Yeah.
Like Las Vegas, where, you know, veterans in Nevada had to get on a bus and go 4 hours to Los Angeles to get their health care. So we made progress there. But you know what's interesting, Roger? After the commission's work was done and we're going to make the announcements of which facilities we're going to close and which ones are going to be realigned, every one of the leaders of the veterans organization stood behind me. They were on board. Every one of them, American Legion, VFW, DAV, Paralyzed Veterans of America, Vietnam Veterans of America, they all stood behind me on that stage and said, we're worried about closing, but we understand the need to do this. Some cases, senator said, sorry, Tony, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. Mr. Secretary, Oh, Mr. Secretary, you're going to build a new hospital in Nevada? Yes, sir.
So right.
That's yeah. the dilemma. And that's why this air commission that didn't go forward had Brack-like authority. It was an up or down vote on the whole package, not individuals.
Right. Yeah, I think that's realistically, that's the only way it's ever going to get done at the end of the day, because it's up or down one way or the other. It's sort of like the National Defense Authorization Act. At a certain point, it's like, yeah, yes or no, and we got to move forward.
Like the Brack, it's the Military Base Realignment and Closure Commission. You know, I chaired that very last Brack Commission in 2005. There should have been one 10 years later. That's what our Brack Commission called for.
Yeah.
In case it worked. It was painful.
Right. So, I'll ask you, I want to hear some Brack stories when we come back, but we're up on the break, Tony. And we could talk about that and a little bit about Brack, and then we'll get back onto the VA a little bit and, just some of the things you think to help ensure the continued delivery of healthcare for veterans, moving forward in the future. My guest today is Anthony Principi. He's a principal at the Principi Group and former secretary of the Department of Veteran Affairs. I'm Roger Waldron. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. I'm Roger Waldron. My guest today is Anthony Principi. He's a principal at the Principi Group and he's former secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Tony, amongst the many in your remarkable career, one of the things you did do is chair, as you mentioned in the last segment, the last BRAC. Perhaps we need another one, but we can discuss that too. But can you talk a little bit about that experience? I know it informed, the whole BRAC process informed your idea of doing what you did when you were secretary in terms of creating the commission. But just it'd be great to hear some stories and just how that sort of worked in our political world, so to speak.
Sure. Yes, I did. I chaired the BRAC commission. I'm convinced that the president was really upset with me when I left the cabinet administration in 2005, and my punishment was to chair the BRAC commission, because there is no more difficult job, I think, in Washington. Even I think one of the senators said, "I can't believe you said yes to this. We got to have your sanity checked to become chairman of this commission." But it's so important, Roger. And I was so honored and grateful to have the opportunity to lead a commission of eight other really just distinguished Americans, former military, civilian officials in government, and because to look at, the national security assessment over the next 20 years, not the 20 years gone by, to make military posture is aligned the way it should be. And the process is the Secretary of Defense puts bases on the list for closure or realignment. And the commission has to decide based upon criteria whether to close them or realign them or not. And the commission has the power to put other bases on the list based on a supermajority vote, which we did in one case. And there were a couple of interesting times. One, of course, was Navy's master jet base down in Oceania. And we had been hearing stories about the encroachment and why it wasn't a safe jet base. And that it should be, some people are saying it should be closed and go back down to Cecil Field in Florida. And I remember being down there at a conference room with the two senators, Virginia, Senator Warner was one of them, and the mayor and the governor and all the military officials from that area, and telling me why it's perfectly safe military base for our fighter pilots. So I said, would you please go out? I said, one of my staff, I said, go out to the flight line and get me two young junior officer F-18 pilots. I want to talk to them. So if you could have seen the look in the room, So a few minutes later, these three lieutenants come into the conference room in their flight suits. sharp looking, good looking. I mean, it's right out of Maverick.
Right.
I mean, he's so sharp. And they're standing at attention. And I ask him, tell me about training here at Louisiana. Can you train the way you have to fight? And this one lieutenant said, sir, no. He said, our job is to train other pilots on making landings and takeoffs from aircraft carriers. We're flight instructors. We're getting them ready to go to sea. And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, because of the encroachment, we have to approach the deck at a different altitude than we would if we were going landing on an aircraft carrier. And we'd have to take off at a different altitude angle because of the encroachment. And they're basically saying they can't do it here. And everybody, I think all of them just want to crawl under the conference room table when these young pilots had the courage to say about that. So we made a tough decision. We put that base on the list for closure unless they took certain steps to eliminate the encroachment, the housing along outside the runway, etc. And it did. It worked out okay. But I'll never forget that moment. Another moment was Cannon Air Force Base. Governor Bill Richardson, and he finds out that Cannon Air Force Base in Las Cruces, New Mexico, is on a list for closure. Destroy the city, the town. And someone tells him, well, Principe went to prep school before the Naval Academy, played football down at New Mexico Military Institute.
Okay.
Oh, that's great. We have nothing to worry about now. Just get down to Roswell, New Mexico. Get all of his memorabilia. We're going to bring it up to him. And he does. He comes up and he brings me all of this stuff, my flag and my jersey, and comes back a second and a third time. And we're at the final day of the thousands of people in this ballroom, and he's in the first seat in the first row looking right at me. And coming around to Air Force bases, and staff is down below like the witness table. I ask them their recommendations, and they give us the recommendations. I call for a vote, and the vote is to close Cannon Air Force Base, and of course, I raise my hand to close them. Well, Bill Richardson stands up, looks at me like looks can kill, storms out of the room. 2 days later, he calls the president and says, Mr. President, I've been invited to go to North Korea to lead it, and I'd like to lead a presidential delegation to recover the remains of service members killed during the Korean War, and maybe we can engage in negotiations about the denuclearization. And but I really would like, Mr. President, I'd like it to be an official presidential delegation. The president says, Governor, absolutely. Presidential delegation, but you're not going to lead it. Oh, well, who's going to lead it, Mr. President? Tony Principe, Secretary. So Richardson tells the president, oh, Tony's my best friend. I love Tony Principe. Okay. He called me that day and left me a voicemail message about what he would do to me if I ever closed another base in his state. But, you know, funny stories in a way, or you got Portsmouth Naval Base, now the submarine base was on the list for closure. Went up there and found out it's one of the best submarine bases in the country. They can turn around a nuke submarine, get it repaired and refueled faster than any other submarine base in the country, shipyard in the country. And
sure.
And we took it off the list. We kept it open. So, you know, it's gratifying sometimes. It's hard sometimes because you know you're impacting people's lives. But if you don't do it, it's going to hurt the country. It's going to hurt our national security posture. And Roger, the same is true for the VA. Either you transform the VA to make it into a 21st century healthcare system, and not the century gone by, for the reasons we stated in earlier segments on the show. I think it's critically important. And without an infrastructure reform commission of some type that has the BRAC-like authority, you can't say yes here, no there. It's all or nothing. The president can send it back to the commission if he doesn't like the recommendations. But at some point, it's got to go forward. Congress has to bless it or not bless it, the whole package. We need that for the VA very, very badly.
Yeah, those are some great stories. And
Yeah, and definitely, you know, your description of the hospitals in Manhattan when you talked about those, and that's just, I mean, people can visualize that. I mean, those are great stories. And one thing I wanted to ask you about your stories in the BRAC, and that it seems to me one of the most important things about that whole process is listening, giving people the opportunity to share their views and demonstrating, you know, sort of that empathy in listening, which is what I've heard from you too. You talk about, you know, the impact on people, and that was considered and is considered, but sometimes there's tough decisions. I think part of human nature, you know, if I get an opportunity to talk and I feel that person cares and is listening, even though we may not agree, you can move forward. Do you have any thoughts to close a segment on that?
I could not agree more, Roger. It is about listening. It's not always about talking. It's about understanding, not the impact on our national security, but on the impact on communities too that make up America, rural America in particular. I certainly, and I believe all my commissioners did the same. We listened. We visited every military base that was on the list, and we had terrific staff that worked night and day, because this is a very time-limited commission. You know, you get confirmed sometime in May, and you have to have the recommendations on the president's list, on the president's desk, by close of business September 8th.
Yeah.
Between May and September, you have got to go out there and look, listen, react. And so you're right. It's about listening.
Right. So, Tony, we're going to take our break now. And when we come back, I just want to get your thoughts, you know, on leadership and some of the, you know, principles or keys to effective leadership of organizations, whether it's, you know, boat in the Mekong Delta versus running the second largest, you know, government organization in the country. Just from your experience, what are some of the key aspects of leadership? My guest today is Anthony Principe. He's a principal at the Principe Group, former Secretary, Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm Roger Waldron. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. I'm Roger Waldron. My guest today is Anthony Principe. He's a principal at the Principe Group and former Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. And, you know, Tony, I wanted to spend a few minutes in the closing the show to give you an opportunity to, you know, provide your thoughts on leadership. You know, again, across your career, you were in Vietnam, you know, you're on you can tell me what the correct term is, but you were like the riverine or the going up the yeah. rivers. You know, you served on a destroyer, I believe. You know, you went to law school. You worked in corporate America. You've served our nation in multiple different facets, whether you mentioned the BRAC Commission, you know, as Secretary of Veterans Affairs, as a deputy, you know, two different Bush administrations. And I just want to get your thoughts on, you know, the keys to leadership. What are some of the principles and things that you've observed and you've tried to, you know, incorporate in your approach to leading men and women and organizations?
Just feel very fortunate. I was raised by an immigrant father who was the hardest working man I've ever known. And of course, as a young immigrant during World War II, went off and spent 4 years on a diesel sub in the Pacific. And went in as a seaman recruit and came out in 18 months later. Life was so bad and so many, you know, loss of life that he became a chief petty officer, which pretty extraordinary for someone to do that. But I think it's a testament to hard work and following your convictions with a lot of humility. And, you know, he embedded those qualities in me. I remember all these young interns would come to work at the VA, and I'd have an opportunity to meet with them. They'd come in a little nervous to meet the secretary. They're there for the summer. And I talked to them about leadership, and I said, you know, one of the most important things I could teach you is it's about relationships. I said, relationships really matter, especially wherever you are. It's how you treat people and how you listen to people that will make the difference in your life. As I said, it made it in my life. If it were not for relationships that I had the good fortune to build when I was counsel in the U.S. Senate and you know, I got to know my mentor, Congressman, a Democrat, Sonny Montgomery in Mississippi, and I was on Armed Services Committee, and he was trying to get a GI Bill passed, the Montgomery GI Bill, and then there was some pessimism, and I worked closely with the Senate Committee, and we got it passed, and he was happened to be President George H.W. Bush's best friend. I mean, President George H.W. and G.V. Sonny Montgomery, a Democrat from Mississippi, were the closest friends in the Congress. So that when President George H.W. got elected, he went to Sonny Montgomery and said, who should I put in my cabinet? And he said, you need to get Tony Principi. So I always stuck with me about working hard, trying to find solutions, having the courage of your convictions, but always treating people with kindness. And so this whole relationships, and I tell those young interns, I said, we all get recycled in Washington. I'm a good example. So don't burn your bridges in Washington, D.C. or wherever you go, because the next person you meet, you make sure that you treated him with dignity and respect. And hopefully it meant something to them. And just reach it. Don't be afraid. Reach across the aisle and talk to your adversaries and try to find some common ground. And that's the only way I've found that you can get things done as a leader. And I hope it helped me and surrounding myself with really smart people, people who are smarter than me. I gave them enormous responsibility. Of course, I held them accountable, but you know, I was not afraid that all of those senior leaders during my time as secretary really knew the issues and were not afraid to express it to me when they felt that I was wrong. And they did.
Right.
And they saved me countless times. Had I gone down the road I wanted to go down the road, it would have been a failure. But they had the courage to come in and talk to me about it, as I had the courage to go to the White House and talk to them about things that I felt were wrong. And I think most of the time it worked out okay.
Yeah, those relationships and being willing to listen, you know, just listening to your description, one of the things it's how you treat people, right? And it's trust, building trust in those relationships. That eventually help you have the opportunity to do good in the world at the end of the day, right?
Absolutely. Right. It is exactly what you said, trust and integrity and treating people with dignity and respect, even if you don't, you know, personally have an issue with them.
Yep.
And we need more of that today. You know, that's not a political statement. We just need, we need more of it in 2024, you know, years. We see the dysfunction and the polarization, and it's not working.
Right.
I don't think it's working, and I hope we can find a way through that, build consensus and common ground.
Yeah, common ground for the common good, and I wouldn't call it a political statement, Tony. I'd call it a civics statement at the end of the day. So I want to thank my guest today, Anthony Principi, principal at the Principi Group and former secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm Roger Waldron. You've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement on Federal News Network. Tune in Tuesday mornings at 11 or subscribe to this show on iTunes or Podcast One.